Each year in sports, records are shattered and championships are won. But the highly paid analysts get to tell you what to think about it. Who's listening to us, the fans?
This is Talk Back, where real fans get to express their own opinions and engage in heated debates about the world of sports as we see it. Welcome to the show. Justin, it's Thursday again, and it's time for another edition of Talk Back. This one's a special one for us. It's number 20. We have week two of the NFL just happened this week, along with the first week in the NASCAR playoffs. Justin, you got reactions coming up on that, I hope.
I do have reactions coming up on that, and we talked about not overreacting to what you see week to week. This is a week-to-week league. Things that we see one week don't necessarily transfer to the next week. So I think that's really what we saw in week one. There were teams that we didn't know what we saw or how to explain it, if it was just sort of a blip on the radar, a road bump in their season, a road game, a bad performance. And we saw in week two, things look completely different. So that was sort of my takeaway. And I think that's going to be for the season, that what you see in one week may not necessarily be what you see for the week or for that team going forward.
Thanks for joining us this week. It's episode 20 of Talk Back. We'll see you after the break.
Week two of the NFL season in the books. Eric, I thought it was a better week of games. The 4 o'clock slate, I thought, had some really good games in it, really good endings. But again, the premier matchups that even we talked about last week, for the most part, outside of maybe the Eagles going to the Chiefs and that being a pretty competitive game throughout, the premier matchups didn't offer us the best on-field product. Week one, the ratings struggled. Again, for the NFL, they were down. Even the opening night, Thursday night game was down. Double-digit percent, according to Bloomberg. So what did you take away from week two with some of the premier matchups not living up to the hype that we thought?
Yeah, I was certainly disappointed in some of the teams that coming into this we thought would be, you know, giving other teams a tough matchup. I mean, particularly, I was looking forward to the Saints against the Patriots, for one. And you look at a team like Drew Brees, and you think of that high-powered offense coming in, and then we talked about how upset Tom Brady would be. Well, we saw one of those two things. We saw Tom Brady be so upset that he threw for over 400 yards. What we didn't see was the Saints have any answer for that. So that game let me down quite a bit. And then the other game that I felt really let down by was Minnesota coming into Pittsburgh. Now, certainly Sam Bradford being out of that game was a big deal. But Minnesota's defense played so much better in week one than they did against Pittsburgh in week two, even without a big performance, as you're going to get to, from Le'Veon Bell. And so that game really let me down, with the spread that ended up being a large Pittsburgh win in that game. And then the game that we talked about, we were both really looking forward to, was Dallas against Denver. And I know, even as a Denver fan,
I wasn't let down.
You weren't let down. But as a football fan, I mean, Dallas was all over them.
Wasn't the results we expected,
no,
for sure.
All over them right from the start. And you could call that game after the first quarter, because no matter what the scoreboard showed, Denver just clearly was the better football team on the field that day.
Well, speaking of let down, let's jump right into it. It opened up with a letdown for the poor Bengals fans. Thursday night football, the Texans come in with a rookie quarterback in his first start. Watson has a 49-yard electrifying TD run, really the only offense in that game. Eric, the Bengals, the first team since 1939 to open up two games at home and not score a touchdown. The Bengals look really bad, and it starts with Andy Dalton. How short is the leash going to be for Dalton with McCarron sitting there? Would the Bengals entertain, you think, making a move at some point? It came out on Monday that there was rumblings in the Bengals locker room of calling for Colin Kaepernick. That aside, does this team make a quarterback change at some point to see what they have, even in a guy like AJ McCarron, or do they just ride this thing out with Dalton?
Dalton is right now the worst quarterback in the league, and that's by QBR even.
And it's by the eye test too.
Yeah, so you're watching those games and you look and you find out that they have AJ Green, who's a phenomenal receiver, and aside from a big 40-yard play here or there, he's not actually scoring. Dalton's not getting him the ball in any moments that matter. Dalton's performance is abysmal. And so I actually, you know, watched that game Thursday night and thought, this is one of the worst products that that NFL could put forth on a Thursday night. Now, certainly they don't go into it saying, hey, let's put the worst games on Thursday nights. Although I'm starting to think that next week with the Niners and the Rams. And, you know, why do we have these awful games on Thursday nights? In any case, Dalton is ranked 32nd in the league in QBR, Marvin Lewis continues to be on the coaching staff of that team as the head coach year after year after year, producing absolutely nothing. My answer to your question is, I think there has to be a short leash, because I know you've paid the guy a lot of money in Andy Dalton. I know that you're waiting to see what develops, but at some point, this becomes his legacy. At some point, there just is no other answer than the fact that he can throw the ball really well at spots, but produces absolutely nothing overall, and you just have to move on, and maybe even move on from a greater standpoint with the coach, too.
Well, that's a great lead-in to the next question. Marvin Lewis has been with the Bengals for 15 years. Record of 118, 105, and three ties. He probably should be fired for figuring out a way to tie three games in 15 years. But regardless, the Bengals are a team normally that seem to be very loyal to their coach. Now, we did see Marvin Lewis make a change at the offensive coordinator in the play-calling position this week, so you can start to see some of the dominoes falling. Outside of Paul Gunther, the defensive coordinator, there's probably not someone on this staff that they feel comfortable just turning the team over to. But going into this offseason, should this be it for Marvin Lewis? Do the Bengals need to just press the reset button on the coaching staff and try that round, maybe as opposed to benching Dalton, but just get a different coach in there?
I think you're going to see Marvin Lewis go based on how he handles the quarterback situation. It's one of those, like we keep talking about, chicken or egg situations. However, his reaction to how Andy Dalton handles this season and how deep in a hole they get in this division, the Ravens are surprising us. They're 2-0. The Steelers we knew would be 2-0 at this point. But, you know, if the Bengals fall so far behind in week 5 and week 6, we're going to be watching how Marvin Lewis handles this quarterback situation. I think you got to give a guy like McCarron a chance at that point just to see what your future might hold. Certainly if they bring in Colin Kaepernick, that would probably be a disaster, and so that would fall to a bad coaching decision. I think Marvin Lewis is going to be on the hot seat real soon and maybe even be one of those coaches that's fired halfway through the season, depending on how this quarterback situation is handled.
He might have to start McCarron just to try to save his job. If you go into week 6, week 7, and you're 2-4, 2-5, and you get McCarron in there and you could go, 5-2 down the stretch or something like that and show some promise, maybe that saves his job. I think unless this team makes a real big turnaround, can get 2 or 3 wins in a row, it's just going to keep building in Cincinnati, because it's been so long since they've been competitive. They have no playoff wins over that 15 years for Lewis. So if he doesn't do something, I think the writing's on the wall
now
for him.
Let's that team they played, the Houston Texans, we talked about that, how early they made a quarterback change last week, and we kind of talked about Bill O'Brien and how that may have been a bit of a shotgun move there, and he's another coach that he's not a quarterback guru as they thought he was, and he might be on the hot seat if this doesn't work out. He made a very early change. It could be questioned by a lot in the league. Now, I know we're only 2 weeks in. The sample size is very small, but Deshaun Watson, that QBR list I was just talking about, he's second.
Well, he's a rookie at least, and the one thing with rookies is it tends to buy coaching staffs a little more time when you put a rookie in, because the ownership doesn't want to switch everything on a rookie. They want to have some continuity there to let them build. But I think the Texans just more of out of necessity had to, because they were going nowhere with Tom Savage. Two teams that don't have to worry about quarterback play, or two that you alluded to when we talked about week number 2, in the Patriots going to the Saints. Tom Brady lit him up, 447 passing yards. The surprising thing for me was Brandon Cooks only with 4 targets. We saw last year when he got 0 targets in the game versus the Rams, he spoke out. That seemed to sort of set in motion his departure from the Saints. So one quick thought on the Patriots, Eric. With Brandon Cooks, if the target share doesn't increase, or the Patriots do what they always do and sort of spread the ball around and he may have his spots to shine, do you think that's a role that he likes, and would that affect him re-signing with the Patriots next year?
It's really hard to tell with a guy like him, because the other thing with the Saints is I think he had that added frustration of the fact that they weren't going to win the Super Bowl. Now he's on a team that maybe buys him a little bit more patience, because they're certainly a top contender in the AFC. By all accounts, should make it deep into the playoffs. And I also think he's going to have big games with the Patriots. Now, he certainly could have those with Drew Brees and the Saints as well, but I think he'll have enough of them with the Patriots that, with their contention in the AFC, probably buys them a little bit of time. So I wouldn't worry about it too much yet. Now, if he has 1 or 2 games where his target share is like maybe 2 looks in a whole game, as a star receiver with a big blockbuster trade in the offseason, he's going to go back to the offensive coordinator and Tom Brady and certainly say something about that.
The bigger news was the Saints. To me, their defense is just atrocious. We saw Sam Bradford light them up in week one, and they made Sam Bradford look like a top five quarterback in this league. And by all accounts, he was probably playing on one leg in that game because he missed week two with a balky knee. It came out that Drew Brees has a contract that doesn't allow the Saints to put the franchise tag on him. So essentially, he could go into this offseason and be a free agent. This Saints team is going nowhere fast because from the defensive side of the football, they are terrible. If you were in Vegas and you could take the Saints look the same next year, or you could take Brees is gone, Peyton is gone, or both, what do you think is the most likely outcome for this team, knowing they're going to have to reset and figure out a way to fix this defense?
I would put my money on Peyton being gone. And the reason I say that is because that's almost happened a couple times through.
It's like every offseason last, what, 3 or 4 years?
Right. That's almost happened a couple times through the years. Whereas Drew Brees, we talked a couple weeks ago about his age. And so the only options that Drew Brees is really going to have is to go to a really awful football team like the Jets or like the Bears or something along those. Well, not the Bears with Trubisky, but like the Jets. And he's not going to want to finish his career like that. I really don't see a guy like Drew Brees wanting to do that. So I think his best option is actually to stay right where he's at, but maybe have a different leadership.
It's hard to say with Brees what he's going to do, because if he's not going to win a title in New Orleans, I know he's tied to that. You are going to have some very quarterback needy teams. And if Drew Brees is available, do other teams maybe that we don't think about step up and make a change? You know, you look at a team like the San Diego Chargers. How long does Phillip Rivers want to play? But there's a team that's got a lot of offensive weapons. They're making the move to Los Angeles in a few years into that new stadium where they want to make a big splashy play with someone like Brees. If things fall apart with the Rams, would they be willing to sign Brees? So I think there's some teams that when a guy of his caliber comes along, there may be some surprises that pop up.
How about him going to the New York Giants?
Well, they could certainly use him. I don't even know if Eli is going to make it through this season after his performance on Monday night, and we'll get into that one. But Eric, a team that the Giants will actually play next week, your beloved Eagles, went in to Kansas City. I know you were worried last week on the show. You weren't sure what your Eagles were going to do, how they could go in and potentially get blown out, demoralize them. I think you have to be pretty happy with your team, how they hung around, how they fought in this game. This was a 13-13 game with just under 12 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. The Eagles had done a very nice job for the majority of the game, bottling up Kareem Hunt, but he did get loose for two touchdowns. Kelce had the crazy touchdown where he sort of dove, glide, hurtled from the five-yard line to get into the end zone. Eagles make a late charge, get the late touchdown onside, have a chance to at least tie this game, fell short. What are your thoughts on the Eagles now, seeing them go into Arrowhead and fight like they did and perform the way they did for at least four quarters in this game, or three quarters in this game?
I'm never happy with losses, but I got to tell you, I was happy with this one. My buddy who's a Chiefs fan, he asked me before the game, what do you think the outcome's going to be? And I said Chiefs by 10. It was Chiefs by 7, so I was happy that, you know, we didn't lose by as many as I thought we would. Now, with that being said, there were a few very good takeaways. Like, you know, this loss didn't kill me because it's, one, out of division. Two, it showed me that the Eagles are good and the Chiefs are better, and I think the Chiefs are going to be a very good football team. But the takeaways that I took from this is Kareem Hunt had one run of 53 yards. Outside of that, he was held to 28 rushing yards. And so, to me, that was a pretty good defensive performance. Likewise, I know Kelce went over 100 yards, but none of their other receivers did. And also, Kelce had a 44-yard reception. So outside of basically two plays, the Eagles' defense kept all of their major offensive stars well under 100-yard performances. Now, on the flip side of the football, Carson Wentz, 333 yards for two touchdowns. He did have that one interception, but he also had 55 rushing yards. So to me, Wentz is proving to be the quarterback that I was hoping he would be, and I still maintain that there's a very good future in Philadelphia. I was very impressed with our tight end, Zach Ertz. I was also impressed that we got the ball to Alshon Jeffrey a number of times, and he scored. I see a lot of good things happening with the Eagles, and I'll talk about it a little bit more in our intriguing matchups going into week three, that I think the Eagles are actually in a pretty good spot.
I think Wentz has looked really good this year. He really looks like he's taken the next step forward. Another game where he's over 300 yards. The thing that scares me about the Eagles, though, is the run game. We talked about LeGarrette Blount, that we didn't know what sometimes in preseason you watch things and you really don't know, especially with veteran players. He struggled. There was so much talk from the beat writers. We didn't know how to parse that with what Doug Peterson was saying. I think this, by all accounts, could be a Eddie Lacy type situation where you could see Blunt being a healthy scratch. And maybe if the Eagles would get some injuries, a candidate to be cut if they need to bring guys in. But Eric, the run game, 13 carries for 51 yards in terms of design runs. Wentz had four scrambles for 55.
And Blunt had none.
And Blunt had one catch and no rushing attempts.
You got it.
Are you concerned about the run game for the Eagles?
I have to be, yes. With how much excitement I had about LeGarrette Blunt coming in, with the season that he had with the Patriots the year before, I had a lot of optimism behind that. And now when I see in week two that he doesn't get a single carry and he only has one reception, he was basically a non-factor. He might as well not have suited up for that game. He was a non-factor. And I got to look at really where we go from here. And that, you know, we talked about it last week, that thought of bringing a guy like Adrian Peterson in, or someone who's dissatisfied with where they are at, we may have to change real soon.
Well, speaking of running backs who we talked about last week with underperforming, Le'Veon Bell, I did not touch him in DraftKings this week, Eric. I talked about it then.
I know I didn't.
I didn't want to. I have to. He's going to have to show it to me on the field first before I have too much exposure to him. Not a bad game. Again, the Vikings defense, we think, is a very good unit. But Bell, 27 carries for 87 yards, only had his longest rush of the day, just 11 yards, four receptions, 4 yards. When does Bell break out of this slump? I think they have a game with Chicago this week. You would think on paper that would be a good candidate, but Chicago's done a pretty good job of bottling up the likes of Devontae Freeman, Jacquizz Rodgers over the first 2 weeks. Bell is obviously a more dynamic back with them. And for the purpose of daily fantasy, I would think Bell's price relative to his points per game and then how that's going to affect his ownership, I think his ownership will be depressed again this week because no one's really knows what to expect out of him. But how surprised are you with Le'Veon Bell that he hasn't been able to really have that big performance so far? And is this because of sitting out with the contract situation?
It's hard to say. Like I said in week one, he's an athlete. He's a tremendous athlete. And so it's hard to know for sure if it's because they're sitting him out, or he sat out, rather, before the season started. However, I trusted him in week one and got burned. I didn't play him at all in week two, thankfully, and he didn't show up really again. I mean, certainly 87 yards is nothing to be too disappointed at, but he needed a lot of carries to get there. So his average tote is not very good. And I just look at that offense, and it seems like Big Ben is getting the ball down the field, but the running game is not materializing the way that it had before. So certainly another week or two, but if this doesn't turn into Le'Veon Bell from a year or two ago, you know, you're now looking at a guy like Jamaal Charles or someone like that who was an absolute stud for a period of time and then sort of has a huge regression and falls off the map. And that can be due to workload. Jamaal Charles got a tremendous workload when he was in Kansas City for those few years that he was an absolute stud. And I think that really wears running backs down. Le'Veon Bell's workload last year was unbelievable because if he wasn't running the ball, it seemed like he was 50% of the time getting a screen. And so he's still running down the field and taking all those hits. I don't know how much that has caught up to him, or like you said, just the offseason not being prepared. Either way, whatever their scheme is, he's not getting the ball efficiently in ways that he can make damage done down the field. And I'm still going to stay away from him next week.
Yeah, I think I will probably too. I may in a lower stakes, maybe a single entry type, try to have some exposure because I think his ownership is going to be potentially single digits because I think there is some worry out there of how the Steelers are using him and what they can do with him to sort of get him jump-started. The Bears' strength is their front seven. They're weak on the back end, so we could see the Steelers attack them again with Antonio Brown, Martavis Bryant, as we saw Ben do this week against the Vikings. Another running back, Eric, that had a very rough week was Zeke Elliott. 9 carries, 8 yards. Dallas goes into Denver and gets really dominated. 42-17 win for Denver. As you said in the opening, if you watch the first two drives of this game in the opening sequence, Denver kicks the ball off to Dallas. Dallas goes 3 and out, punt the ball to Denver. Denver goes right down the field, get the touchdown to Emmanuel Sanders. At that point, it just felt like Denver was in control of this game. You could start to see that Zeke was getting frustrated, that Dallas as a whole was getting frustrated. I talked about last week in the preview, I thought Dak would really struggle against Denver's no-fly zone secondary, and we really saw that. It took him 30 completions on 50 attempts just to get 238 yards. It was dink and dunk offense. I think for Denver, we know that their defense is really good. Denver's very good at home. Simeon has looked very efficient so far in this offense. But Eric, from a Dallas standpoint, I didn't think Dak looked very good week one against the Giants. I thought, as bad as the Giants are in Dallas, that offensive line for the Giants is awful. I thought Dallas let the Giants hang around. They never could put them away. Dak looked inaccurate in week one. You've had all this drama around Zeke, all this drama around the team. Now, Jerry Jones potentially could be blocking Goodell's contract situation. There's always drama with Dallas. But how good do you think this Cowboys team is? You're an NFC East fan with the Eagles. We thought Dallas would be one of the upper echelon teams fighting for this division win. I haven't been that impressed with them so far. What's been your take on them?
I think on paper, they're still one of the best teams in the NFC East. Here's where I'm looking at them going, I think they may have a problem, and it's this. Last year at 13-3, and really could have been 14-2, but they rested a lot of guys in that 17th week. At 13-3 last year, they were firing on all cylinders, and they were riding the high of rookie players, Dak Prescott, Ezekiel Elliott, and still had healthy Jason Witten and Dez Bryant, and they were really, really playing a good football program all the way through the season. Now their program is struggling because they're facing adversity. And now you have young players facing adversity really for the first time, and we're seeing how it's materializing on the way that they play in the field and on their faces as they sit on the bench. I was very, very unimpressed with how Zeke Elliott handled a little bit of adversity against a tough Denver defense. If you want to be a great running back in this league, you can't let a few carries at 0 yards get you down. You've got to say, okay, the next one I'm going to bust through the line and go for 12 yards. He really reminded me of like a Terrell Owens yesterday, the way he was pouting over there on the sidelines. And I was very unimpressed by that. Dak Prescott, I'm not so hard on him because I think with the style of quarterback that he is, you're going to have games like that. You're going to have these monster games where he has 250 yards passing and 80 yards rushing, some phenomenal scrambles, some, a rushing TD and maybe two passing TDs. He went up against a Denver defense that's a very good defense. So I don't necessarily look at that as a red flag on Dak Prescott. But the running game, if you can't run the football at all, and I mean even for 30 or 40 yards, what is Dak going to do? And Ezekiel Elliott basically took himself out of that game. Even Dez Bryant, who's a pouter, was trying harder than Ezekiel Elliott, later on in that game with some of the catches that Dez had, trying to keep the drives alive. But boy, you face a little bit of adversity and you behave that way, I wasn't too impressed.
Especially on the interceptions that were thrown. Zeke really did nothing, especially in the Chris Harris interception. Zeke just stood there, and Jason Garrett called him out for it after the game in the post-game press conference of, he tried to mask it of saying, well, Zeke's a competitive kid, and he was just frustrated. But there was also some, we're going to have some sit-down and come-to-Jesus comments with him or conversations with Zeke, because that's unacceptable. You cannot just go out in the football field and just quit and just stand there and watch 11 players from the defense run by you and try to get a run back. Tlaib did it to him at the end where, there was guys just not hustling back. And you saw basically Dak get run over, at least trying to make a play. I think what I see with Dak is if the run game is not there and Dallas can't stay balanced, and I'll pose this question to you, is Dak good enough if they face a really good defense? And really, we've yet to see that in the NFC outside of maybe Seattle. But if Zeke isn't going and they're not balanced and Dak has to win a game with his arm, do you trust him that he can go do that? Or do you feel that he needs a more balanced approach to keep defenses, off guard where he can use some more play action? Because to me, Dak didn't do anything. And coming into the game, I really wasn't scared of Dak. I thought that was going to be the game plan. Stack the box and make Dak beat you and let Denver's corners line up man to man. And I wasn't really impressed with what Dak did. He didn't really burn Denver at all in this game.
I still got to give Dak a little bit of credit. I mean, look at last year, even as a rookie, one of the top things that people said about him from an analyst standpoint is that he was really smart with the football. He can make good throws and he can also make good decisions. His interception ratio was very low last year, even as a rookie. And so I think if he carries on those fundamentals, he'll get through tough weeks like this. It's still too early to be seen, though. Is Dak Prescott a guy like Russell Wilson who will have some staying power in this league, even with the way that he plays football, or will he turn out more like an RG3 or a Colin Kaepernick, where the skill set to stand in the pocket and throw the ball and find receivers just doesn't supersede his ability to scramble and run and be a mobile quarterback? If those things don't balance out long enough, that's where you start to see problems in year three or four. And certainly this year will tell us that. But I still look at him potentially as a more of a Russell Wilson type, maybe even an Alex Smith type, where I think he's smart enough with the football. It'll get him through some of these rough games. But I've seen Dak make some phenomenal throws too. So I'm not gonna be too down on him yet. But certainly it's something to keep an eye on.
I think you're exactly right. I think he is more of a Russell Wilson, Alex Smith type quarterback than a Kaepernick RG3. He definitely is a quarterback that can look through his progressions, and he doesn't necessarily look to run all the time. You see him stay in the pocket and just kind of have a little bit of that Aaron Rodgers, where he just sort of moves around within the pocket and he doesn't look to just tuck and run. So I do think that's a good upside for him. And again, Denver's defense is elite within the secondary. Just for more going forward, if Dallas gets into a playoff game versus Seattle, versus a team that can play some defense, is that going to be an issue going forward? We will wait to see. Speaking of Russell Wilson, Seattle was in the 4 o'clock game versus the Niners. This was not an intriguing game for us because we actually thought Seattle would go home and take care of business. Eric, it took a fourth quarter late drive by Russell Wilson just to win this game. The Seattle offensive line is terrible. And in your opinion, is that going to be what holds this team back? Because it doesn't look like any help is on the way. And are they just going to waste this year and limp into the playoffs and get beat because their offensive line is so bad? Or is Russell Wilson even going to make it through this year?
We tried very hard not to overreact in week one, and we're going to try again not to overreact in week two. But I had my eyes open to a few things in week two. Number one, remember in week one, we talked about that Seahawks versus Packers game. We talked about how well the Seahawks played on the defensive side of the ball for so long, and yet they just couldn't seem to stay on the right side of the scoreboard, and then Green Bay dominated them in the second half. Now we're starting to see some of those cracks and where the problems really lie, which is that Seattle goes and plays a pretty bad team. And,
at home.
And barely wins. And now I think you say there might be major problems here that, you know, no matter how good their defense is, and certainly their defense still held Hoyer looked like one of the worst quarterbacks in history of the game. You know, San Francisco just looks bad. Carlos Hyde.
15 for 27 for 94 yards. That's bad.
Carlos Hyde is the only bright spot is seemingly on that offense. And you know, he did quite well, actually, against Seattle. But Seattle's offense is just not going to be good enough this year, I think, to keep them looking deep into the playoffs. And now on the other side of that, when we talked about the Packers and the Seahawks game last week, now we see the Packers go and play Atlanta, who Atlanta, we said, struggled against the Bears in week one. We tried not to overreact to that, and I'm glad we didn't, because Atlanta looked like the best team in the NFL, aside from maybe the Patriots, in week two. So, you know, the Falcons... The Falcons are not in any trouble like we might have thought they were in week one. The Falcons looked unbelievable. And so when you look at the Packers, the Falcons, possibly the Eagles, you know, I just don't see the Seahawks making it far enough to get to a Super Bowl. I mean, they're just going to really struggle.
They're lucky they're in a bad division, because they'll probably make the playoffs regardless of what happens and how bad they play, because the Cardinals look way worse than we thought. The Rams don't look much better than we thought, and the Niners are already talking about going to C.J. Beathard. But those Falcons, Eric, that we talked about, we didn't want to overreact to what we saw in Chicago in week one. Again, it's a road game. It's versus the Bears. They have a huge matchup coming up in week two. We said there, let's pump the brakes a little bit. Let's see how they look versus Green Bay opening their stadium. They looked electrifying. We're actually up 31-7 at one point. And I actually thought they went the opposite way of what they did in the Super Bowl. They got way too conservative early in the third quarter of this game, just trying to run the ball literally every series instead of trying to stay balanced. Green Bay scored some points. This game was never in doubt. From the Falcons' standpoint, Eric, I think they're as good as we thought they were. They're going to be a team that, when they're at home, they're going to be dominant. I think in our intriguing matchups, we'll get to one that I think will be very intriguing in week three, involving the Falcons going to Detroit and why that is. From a Green Bay standpoint, though, Jordy Nelson goes out early in this game. They've got issues with the offensive line with injuries. What did you see from the Packers that you can now take away? They only scored 17 points at home versus Seattle. We saw San Francisco be able to move the ball on Seattle in Seattle. Do you still feel good about this Packers defense? Is this just a blip of going into a much more hyped up Atlanta team as they open up a brand new stadium? Or is there, do you see something in Green Bay that you want to watch for going forward?
I think in Green Bay, you see that their defense is going to suffice with 90% of the teams that they play, and that it's going to struggle against a team like a Patriots if they get to the Super Bowl or the Falcons. I think they're okay. What kind of shocks me about the Packers right now is how slow they get started in these football games. Aaron Rodgers won them the game against Seattle in week one based on the second half that he had. He also played much better in the second half, and the entire offense played much better in the second half against the Falcons, but they were already down by so many points that it was kind of a moot point. If they can't stay in football games at the beginning, their defense may become a bigger problem as they play better teams in the playoffs. So for the Packers, I don't think it's panic. I still think they're one of the better teams in the NFC, and certainly I hope they don't lose Jordy Nelson or that's going to be a problem with their offense, but Devontae Adams played very well. I thought, well, they also lost Randall Cobb near the end of that game. I don't think it was a major injury as long as his shoulder's not got any broken bones or tears, but they did lose Cobb at the end of that game as well. I guess, you know, I'm a wait and see guy on the Packers. I think they're still as good as they need to be for the division that they're in. But I got to tell you, if they get to the playoffs, you don't want to be down 31-7 against the Falcons in the playoffs.
No, and I keep bringing this up. It feels like home field advantage in the NFC is going to be so important, because if Atlanta it gets home field advantage throughout, I think they're going to be a tough team to play. And I think the Packers would need it as well in the elements of Lambeau bringing a team like Atlanta off the turf there. I think that's a huge advantage for them. So we'll have to wait and see with the Packers and how they look going forward. Boy, something's never changed from week one, and that's the Giants offensive line. They looked atrocious. The Giants look like a team that are on the verge of a complete meltdown. We saw them on Monday night at home just get manhandled by Detroit. Ben McAdoo calls out Eli postgame on Monday night for the botched goal line, 4th-and-2 going for it. Eli takes a delay of game. McAdoo basically says it's sloppy play. A veteran quarterback can't make that happen, and he shouldn't have to call a quarterback or a timeout from the sideline. When he has a veteran quarterback, he expects the play to get called. Some harsh criticism for Eli. Eric, this Giants team, we've seen them start off years before looking bad, looking like they are a team that's going nowhere fast. Same story again this year. This team does not look very good as we clean up week two here and head to week three.
The problem for the Giants, though, is that they don't have time. The Eagles are so much better than they've been in the past 5 years. The Cowboys are so much better than they've been, we think, in the past 4 or 5 years. The Redskins, I think, are still an improved football team over what they were a few years ago. So in my eyes, it simply comes down to the fact that the Giants do not have time. They go in and play the Eagles this week. If they lose that game and start the season 0-3, especially, you know, losing divisional games, you got major problems on your hands. And that's why I made the comment earlier about does Drew Brees go to a team like the Giants? And the reason I say that is because if you get to the end of this season with a veteran quarterback like Eli, and it's a 7-9 season or even worse, like a 6-10 season, and you finish last in the division, if I'm the Giants, it may be time to just completely shake that up and you know, see what you can do with a guy like Brees for the remaining 3 years of his career, because Eli is no spring chicken. He's been around a long time now. Kudos to him for winning 2 Super Bowls. I think he lucked out in a couple of plays in both of those Super Bowls. And, you know, other than that, I don't feel like Eli's just this amazing Hall of Fame quarterback outside of those 2 Super Bowls. And so when you see a season like this has started where he just looks aged, he looks to be making poor decisions, and he looks, quite frankly, uninterested sometimes. You just can't do that in the NFC East, and they're going to be in a hole. They're going to find themselves in a hole so deep that by, you know, halfway through the season, it's over.
And their schedule does not get any easier. They go to Philadelphia. They have a game with the Bucks. They play Denver here in a few weeks. They even play the Rams team that's really good up front now with Aaron Donald back. If they don't fix this offensive line, I don't think it matters who's that quarterback back there, even if it's Tom Brady. If you only have 1 second to throw and you have no run game and you're just getting blasted. I mean, Eli took a hit last night where I don't think I've ever seen a quarterback get lit up like he did and get a man just smash him into the ground late in that game. Eli has an incredible streak of game starts and durability, but I think this offensive line is going to put that to the test. Week two also, Eric, a ton of injury news this week. It came out on Tuesday morning. Jordy Nelson, he's not serious with the quad injury. He's 50-50 to play in week three, according to Adam Schefter. Gronkowski, we know how the Patriots are with injuries. He had two men fall on his back. The Patriots said it's a groin injury. Not sure how that works, but we'll wait and see with Gronkowski. Sam Bradford is up in the air for week three as well. The big injury, I know, for the Panthers and for your fantasy team, Eric, was Greg Olsen, broken foot, out 6 to 8 weeks. Just a quick thought on how do you think that affects the Panthers?
It's bad news because Cam Newton is still seemingly regressing. If I'm the Panthers, I'm really nervous right now. 2016 Cam Newton appears to be gone. 2015 Cam Newton appears to be gone. And I don't know where he went, and I don't know why he's gone, because he's a physical specimen. You would think that he could just overcome some of these problems that he's having, and yet it seems to keep going on and on and on. Last year, Cam Newton, a lot of people said, just wasn't the same Cam Newton, and we thought maybe it was that come down from the Super Bowl loss and just all the things that you kind of deal with. It's not any better in another subsequent season. He played the other night with zero passing touchdowns and, you know, had some rushing yards, but zero rushing touchdowns. He doesn't seem to be leading that team. Now, they're a 2-0 team, but they're probably the worst 2-0 team in the NFL right now. So you lose a guy like Greg Olsen, and that's really a disaster, because that was Cam's security blanket. If he can't find Benjamin, he can't find Funches, if he can't find McCaffrey, Olsen was his security blanket. Now you take him away, I don't see this team getting any better, and they've got a tough schedule with where they're at.
Well, let's jump right into week three, and let's take a look at some of the intriguing matchups, because I know, speaking of Greg Olsen and those Panthers, that is on your list. And I swear, if you say Rams Niners are on your list, I'm going to walk off this podcast right now.
No, we're going with intriguing games and okay. The Thursday night football game. Outside of being intriguing for the fact that the NFL seems to schedule the worst product possible on Thursday night. Now, I don't even know that if I don't have any fantasy players, I don't even know that I'll watch Thursday night. And that's a big deal for me because I watch a lot of football. But you're right. On my list of intriguing games this week, I do find the Saints at the Panthers intriguing for the fact that the Saints are 0-2, the Panthers are 2-0. And I feel like these teams are two teams that don't match their record. In other words, I think the Saints go into Carolina. I think they beat them, and I think they beat them pretty good.
Wow.
I think we see a Saints offense that is sort of like we saw with the Patriots this past week. I think we see them upset. I think we don't want to see them going 0-3. And I think they go in there, and I think they light Carolina up. And I think Cam continues on with his problems. And so you don't have the Carolina Panthers at 3-0 after this week.
If Cam can't look good versus that Saints defense, the Panthers got a lot of trouble. One game after Monday night that I find intriguing now is the Falcons going to the Lions. Now, we've seen the Falcons struggle on the road. Now, they do get to go to Detroit where they are in the dome on turf. So you would have to think that's a little bit more of an advantage for them than playing outside on grass. So I'm intrigued to see how the Falcons look off a big win. Can they continue this streak, or do they struggle on the road? It'll tell me a lot about this team going forward. Eric, I know there's another matchup we both have involving your beloved Eagles. You got to tell me that's on your list.
Absolutely. The Giants at the Eagles is on my list, and it's for this reason. The Giants cannot lose that game, and the Eagles, by winning that game, would look pretty good in the division with already two division wins. And so I look at that as a very intriguing game, because if the Eagles can possibly put the Giants in an 0-3 hole in that division, I think that's a huge win for the Eagles if they can get it.
So what else do you have on your list? The one I had was Bucks-Vikings, but that is if Sam Bradford plays. So we'll have to wait to see if that matchup, because I don't know if I want to watch a lot of Case Keenum versus that Bucks defense. So do you have anything else on your list?
No, you hit them all. I think this week three is not as intriguing as the prior 2 weeks. I also had the Falcons and the Lions. I think we want to see where we're at with the Lions being 2-0, if they're really that good, or if it's a product of playing, like we just said, a Giants team that was not very good. And so I think that's a good matchup. And one of those teams is going to come out of there 3-0, and I think possibly considered one of the better teams in the NFC. Stafford has impressed me. He got the big contract, and he's played well so far, so good for him.
Well, week three, as Eric alluded to, not that great of a slate of matchups, but we have seen that some of those strange games involving strange teams do tend to have some really nice outcomes and be some dramatical games. Probably not a lot of people were watching Arizona and the Colts game on Sunday, but it ended up being a pretty good game, as was the Chargers and Dolphins. the Raiders going to the Redskins. Raiders look like a dominant team. Redskins have struggled, but that's a matchup that doesn't happen very often because of out-of-conference play. Only about every 4 years that those teams would match up, and only every 8 years the Raiders come to Washington. So that'll be sort of an intriguing game. So that wraps it up for our segment one NFL talk. When we come back, we're going to jump into Talkworthy, touch on college football, NASCAR, and a few more items.
Justin, it's time for Talkworthy, where we go around and hit up some current events. And we're going to switch gears. We talked a lot of football in segment one, and we do have more football to talk with the NCAA. But I want to jump quickly over to the Major League Baseball situation. We are now very close, 2 weeks, I believe, to deciding who goes to the playoffs in Major League Baseball. Three teams in each league seem to be solidified. Out of the National League, you're going to have the Dodgers and Nationals and Cubs fairly safely at this point in the playoffs, and the Diamondbacks and Rockies in that wild card spot. Now, what's intriguing to me about the National League playoffs is what could happen. If it ended today, we'd have the Diamondbacks playing the Rockies and the winner of that going on to play the Dodgers. And as we talked about, Dodgers here have been struggling over the past month. I think the Rockies or the Diamondbacks could go into a series with the Dodgers and potentially beat them. Do you have any kind of predictions on what you might see as that series, or who do you think is going to come out of the National League to go to the World Series? Do you think the Cubbies are going to go again?
They have the pedigree to do it. I mean, the Dodgers have had good teams over the years with what we felt was very elite pitchers, and even with Kershaw, we've seen him struggle in the postseason, and sometimes when you continue to see things happen year over year, series after series in the playoffs, we talked about with the Bengals even, when you can kind of have that pressure on you, the more you lose, the more pressure that's there to succeed. I could easily see the Dodgers going in and getting knocked out by one of these hot wildcard teams because, you know, the Rockies or the Diamondbacks are going to give them a series, and it's a short series. So if they go in and slip up in one game and they split at home and then they have to go on the road, that series could be over very quickly. So I think the Cubs at least have the pedigree. They've been there. They know how to win. They know how to win close series, how to finish out seven-game series, how to win in game seven. So I think the Cubs have the pedigree and the experience to get it done again, or at least get back to the World Series.
In the American League, we have the Astros, Red Sox, and Indians at this point, as of Thursday morning this week, being the teams that are, you know, going to go on and be in the playoffs for sure, with the Yankees versus the Twins in the wild card matchup. I don't know that that's a game that I will really watch because I don't care about either the Yankees or the Twins. However, it's intriguing to me from the standpoint that you have a couple of good stories developing out of the American League. I think it would be neat to see the Indians get back to the World Series, especially as well as they have played, to see if they could go on to go ahead and win that. Certainly the way they lost was, I mean, great for the history of baseball in terms of the Cubs, but sad for the Indians, and that would be a neat story. Furthermore, it would kind of be neat this year to see the Astros go to the World Series and possibly win. The one thing I will say as we wrap up just the divisional part of it is what's neat in baseball right now is the parity that we're seeing. We've seen World Series champions come out of Kansas City and Chicago, places that, you know, had longed for these titles for years and years and years. Now we still see possibilities of that in Cleveland again, or Houston, and, you know, the Washington Nationals. I think this World Series, depending on who gets in there, could be another World Series that I watch every inning of all potentially seven games, because it could be that intriguing based on who gets in. What would be a dream matchup for you based on the teams that we see here? What do you think would get eyeballs to the sport of baseball in a World Series? What matchup is intriguing to you?
Well, I think you could look at a rematch from last year. If you get the Indians back in there and the drought that they've been on, it would be nice to see them win a title. And the city of Cleveland might need that, because when LeBron leaves after next year, they're going to at least have something they can fall back on.
We don't have NBA on this show, and yet you had to bring that up.
We got to put it in, because the city of Cleveland, they better get a title right now, because it could be a while before they get one in any other sport if LeBron leaves. But again, what the Houston area has been to, as good as the Astros have been this season, that would be another fantastic story if they could get there, have World Series games in Houston as that city rebuilds, kind of bring some attention back there for all that's been done. We know in this country, stories move along quickly, and as much attention that was paid to the victims in Houston, they'll be forgotten about on the national level. It would be nice to see some of that rebuilding process kind of get brought back to the forefront, and that there's not a city in the world that in the U.S. that would need it more than them to get eyeballs back in there. You think of the amount of visitors that would be in there for multiple World Series games. So that one, probably from a standpoint of a storyline and one of those kind of pull at your heartstrings and storybook type endings, would be, I think, probably even a better situation than even Cleveland.
The other topic in the news for Major League Baseball is Giancarlo Stanton. Now, he's unfortunately resting right around 55, 56 home runs in 2 weeks left in the season. He needs 6, 7, 8 home runs to get over this mark. Where are we going to be at with him? Is he going to make it?
I think he's probably going to come up short. Just the pace that he's on, he's going to have to hit one, you know, every other game. He's going to need probably a multi-home run game to get there. And, you know, this is not easy to do. What he's doing is pretty historical as it is, much less to think that he's going to be able to get, you know, 6, 7 more home runs to make a run at this record. So as the season's dwindled down, he hasn't hit quite as many. When we talked about this story a few weeks ago, I think he was 9 away or so with, you know, 30 some games left. And we really thought at that point he had a good chance to do it. His pace has slowed down. So unless, you know, we've seen him get red hot, and it's not out of the question to think he could have, you know, a streak of 3 or 4 games in a row where he hits one, maybe gets a 2-homer game in there. But if I was betting on it, I would say he's probably going to come up short of the record.
From a sport that develops a little bit slowly on the field to a sport that goes pretty darn fast, the NASCAR series ended its first playoff race this past week in Chicagoland Speedway. Justin, unfortunately, though, much of the same. Martin Truex Jr., and I don't say unfortunately because I have anything against Martin Truex Jr. I think he's a great guy. But look, he's dominated the season.
Not much to watch.
It's just not exciting. He's dominated the season. He wins the first playoff race. That puts him in the round of 12, so he's already secure there. Not to mention he adds 5 playoff points. He just keeps adding to that total. I still contend that there's no way that he doesn't make it to Homestead and be one of the top 4. And look, I don't have a problem with that. One of the things I really do get tired of when you follow NASCAR fans on Twitter is all of these convoluted ways to make it so that the best driver doesn't win the championship. I'm not one of those guys. Look, if Martin Truex Jr. earns his way to Homestead and dominates Homestead and wins the race, I think that's really just a summary of the 2017 NASCAR season, and he deserves it. So I'm not one of these guys that's trying to find a way to get Casey Kane to Homestead so that he might have a chance to win the title. Look, Casey Kane doesn't deserve it. Too bad. You know, so if Truex gets there and wins a title, that's great. But I just don't think the excitement is there when this type of thing happens.
I think from the standpoint of what is happening with NASCAR is Truex is dominating these races, and then it feels like people want a caution to come out every race with like 3 laps to go and screw him out of it, and that somehow fixes NASCAR. I don't think that fixes the overall problem. I was at the Richmond race live. I watched Truex dominate that race. There was green flag stops. Guys had chances to short pit and try to make up time. He came out. He still dominated that race. At that point, with 2 to go, I was fine with him winning because of that. I wanted to see him win. He had by far the best car on the racetrack, and it didn't fix the fact that he got crashed at the end of like, oh yeah, that just erases the fact that he dominated the race in my mind. I don't see how that fixes anything. Truex has been the best car all season. He deserves to be in the position that he's in. Even if he doesn't win the title, in my mind, he was by far the most dominant car. Even if he goes to Homestead in a one-off situation and he doesn't win it, I don't really care who the champion is because I know the best car that I saw on the track this year, and that was Martin Truex Jr. He's dominated the mile and a half tracks. He's won on the road course. We've seen him dominate short track races. That car's good everywhere it goes. In my opinion, NASCAR can trick the system up however they want. It's not going to change in my mind what I've seen from this car and how dominant that he's been all season.
The one last thing we'll say about NASCAR, and we want to see how this develops as the playoffs continue here, but we talked about the fact that some of the cars that look really good heading into the playoffs, and even this first week, Logano got a top 10, aren't in the playoffs. And if we had taken the points just as they rank without putting drivers ahead of other drivers based on the win and you're in philosophy, there were some drivers that are in the playoffs now that wouldn't be there versus guys that, you know, like Bowyer and Logano who would be there. Now, how do you think that's going to affect the product of racing as we get further into the playoffs? And do you think NASCAR, I know you have some ideas, do you think NASCAR should continue to think through this and possibly change it? Or do you think that they've changed so many things in the last 10 years that we should live with this and just let them, you know, stay where they're at and hope that they don't change anything for 5 or 6 years?
Well, they've changed so much stuff, maybe they can't do anything. My point when we were texting back and forth was guys like Austin Dillon and Casey Kane, for example, they just haven't run that great all year. I think coming into this race, they both had like 3 top 5s and 4 top 10s. And you look at guys like Logano and Bowyer and even Eric Jones that are, you know, 8, 9 double digit top 10 runs. And we're almost 200 points ahead of these guys just in the regular point standing. I don't always like the win and you're in philosophy because it's like guys sort of quit. It feels like after they win, like, oh, we got our win in the bank. There's no way 16 cars are going to win. We're going to get in. I would rather see NASCAR give the 40 points for the win and then give a 50 point bonus for a victory. But it still makes you run hard the rest of the year. You shouldn't just be able to win a race and just your goal be to run in the top 30 in points to just get into the chase. Because I don't think the best cars are in there. I would much rather see the field out with guys like, you know, Joey Logano and Eric Jones and Clint Bowyer, guys that have shown they can run up front and be competitive, where guys like Casey Kane, yes, he won the Brickyard, but it took two of the best cars getting wrecked and strategy to get him there. Same with Austin Dillon. It took him a long fuel mileage run where some of these top guys weren't going to take that chance, and the situation works out for him to get a win, and he hasn't done anything else. So that's the one tweak I'd like to see NASCAR make. I think the point of playoffs is that you get the 16 best cars in there that ran the 26 races, not a guy that's been okay and lucked into a win. And I know that, yes, you have to run strong to be in a position to capitalize, but let's face it, Kyle Busch at Charlotte was by far the best car in that race. Austin Dillon just worked him on fuel mileage and limped across the start-finish line. It's not very exciting watching a guy run laps 2 and 3 seconds off the pace to save fuel. And yet he gets into the playoffs and you see a guy like Joey Logano with a win that's encumbered and all this and that. But you still see that the 22 car has speed. I'd much rather see those guys in the chase fighting for it than guys that are probably going to get knocked out in the first round unless your chase contenders start to have problems here at New Hampshire and Dover.
Now that they have the two different point standings, I feel like they could do something with this idea that you have where maybe they do a bonus point situation that just goes to playoff points. And the regular standings, it's not winning you're in, it's the regular standings. Now, they could still do segment points and stage points the way that they've done and add those to the regular points. I don't have a problem with that. It does give that segment or stage racing a bit more excitement that goes into the regular points. But then give this big, you know, chunk of points that only goes into the playoff points pool. And that way, if you have a guy like, let's say, Newman, who wins a race, he gets a big chunk of playoff points and they're sitting there. But so what? If he doesn't get into the playoffs, that's null and void and those points don't matter. That still incentivizes him to participate the entire year to try to get more regular season points to be in that top 16. I think there's ways that they could do this to make the regular season competition more exciting. And again, reward a guy like Martin Truex Jr., who's been dominant, without taking it away from him if a guy like, you know, Newman or Kane wins a race and sneaks in and then somehow gets into the playoffs undeservedly and then, you know, it gets crazy from there. I think you got to reward these guys for the consistency. I think that's what traditional fans of 40 years ago loved about NASCAR, right? Is that
you have to find a way to blend it.
When Dale Earnhardt, you know, dominates a season, you don't want him going into a chase and not winning a title. That's just not how it works. You know, IndyCar, Jeff Gluck was just talking about this with IndyCar. IndyCar had a phenomenal season this year where they actually went to the final race of the season with 5 guys mathematically having a chance to win the championship, and that gave them a really exciting race. And so they've somehow found a way to keep the points really tight but still reward the guys that drive well all year.
Well, just think about this. No other sport wants to penalize their best team. You know, just because the Golden State Warriors have the best record, the NBA doesn't say, oh, you have to play 2 extra series now and you have to go on the road for all your series. No, you get home court advantage throughout the playoffs. And if you have the best overall record, you get it in the finals. I don't understand why NASCAR fans want to make it the opposite way. Like, they get mad because the guy's good. you can't fix that. You can't penalize it because they're fast, and you maybe it's not the most dramatic races to see. That's just how the season's playing out. That's something that NASCAR has to fix within the cars to make the product better so that you can't have one car that goes out. But you can't penalize the 78 team because they found speed and that they've been dominant.
Speaking of penalizing teams for playing good, I have a little bit of a... I'm a little bit bitter over the fact that people have talked down on Penn State all week for beating Georgia State 56-0. Look, that's just how college football works.
Did
people.
Anybody in the top 25 play anyone decent outside of a few games, Clemson and Louisville?
I'm telling you, that's how college football works. So the people that want to you know, yell and scream about Penn State getting a great win against a Georgia State team, let me know how Alabama does against Mercer College later this year. Look, they all do it. And so what they look at is, okay, this particular week, you know, Penn State played this team. And this particular week, well, these two ranked teams, you know, Oklahoma and Ohio State played. So clearly Penn State just is terrible. And Ohio State, even though they lost, is better because they played a ranked opponent. You can't take it week by week like that. Look at these teams' entire schedules. You tell me that Penn State wouldn't roll Mercer College too, just like Alabama's going to roll. I mean, it's ridiculous. They all do it. And that's what the system has provided, the way that they do the rankings, the way that they penalize these teams for losses, the way that they penalize Penn State for losing to Pitt last year in September, somehow came back to bite them, you know, in December after they had won the Big Ten and won the head-to-head matchup against Ohio State. Penn State didn't get placed in the top four due to a loss 3 months prior to a Pitt team that, oh, by the way, had beat Clemson, the team that went on to beat, you know, win the national championship. So look, I don't want to hear that anymore. Penn State played Georgia State. It's who they had on their schedule. You can yell and scream about scheduling tougher games all you want, but the problem is the way the system's set up, when teams play tougher games and they lose, they may never recover from that. So one philosophy is do all you can to be 12-0 and win your conference and then see where it shakes out. Justin, there are a number of teams still 3-0 headed into week four of the college football season. And so this week, to me, it's all about the battle of the 3-0s. Some of them are consequential. Some of them really aren't. Speaking of that Penn State Nittany Lions team, they go to Iowa this week and play a 3-0 Iowa team that's not ranked, but is their first tough Big Ten matchup. So that's an intriguing game to me. Alabama goes and plays a 3-0 Vanderbilt team in Tennessee that, by all accounts, Alabama should roll them because 3-0 in the SEC right now just doesn't mean a whole lot. I think we see the Saban effect starting to actually backfire to where the SEC just isn't that good. And you're seeing that with Florida and Kentucky and some of these other teams. USC, who just came off a really tough win against Texas, goes and plays a 3-0 Cal. And then there's a couple of games that could, I think, be exciting, which is TCU at Oklahoma State, although I still would pick Oklahoma State to win that because it's at home and they're high-powered offense with
they're
their
still a 12-point favorite, too.
Well, yeah, with their Heisman candidate, I think they're still going to roll that game. Mississippi State at Georgia, the 17 versus 11, that could be a good matchup of 3-0s. And then finally, the late game, Washington at 3-0 Colorado. So there's a little bit of meat there for the college football schedule this week, but I think now what you're seeing is we're getting into the conference schedules. You're going to start to see teams win and lose and get these, you know, get these records to where a loss is going to be a very detrimental thing. Ohio State's loss to Oklahoma last week wasn't that big of a deal, again, because it's also out of conference. But now if Ohio State loses again, that's their season. It's done.
Yep.
And so that's the risk you run. Let's talk about that Heisman watch. What are your thoughts on the five, let's say five top guys in the Heisman race?
Well, for me, I think right now it's all quarterbacks. Now, I know you'll have you like the Penn State running back. You'll have him in there. But I think it really is, you know, the performances we've seen from Baker Mayfield, you know, even early on Lamar Jackson. Now, he struggled on Saturday night with playing Clemson at home with that loss that they took. But he still, you know, had a pretty good game over 300 yards. You know, Josh Rosen has just been lighting it up with 400-yard games. You know, Sam Darnold has been very consistent in his performance. His interceptions are up, which, you know, some may think is a little bit of an alarm there. But we saw that same thing with Jameis Winston when he came back to Florida State his last year. His interceptions were up as well. And then the Oklahoma State quarterback, Mason Rudolph, has jumped in as well with his 1,135 passing yards so far with 11 touchdowns, one interception. So let me throw it to you as a Jets fan who's in need of a quarterback. When you look at these guys, And let's face it, it's probably going to be a discussion between Josh Rosen and Sam Darnold. Rosen has more impressive numbers. Darnold has seemed to be able to make the big throws when it counts and get his team the win. You know, you saw the performance he had at versus Texas, where he just looked like a professional quarterback back there, just making throws and making the right decisions. Which one jumps out at you from both, let's say from both a Heisman standpoint first, and then what you project in the NFL right now with 3 weeks into the college football season?
Just right now, I would take Darnold. And part of that comes from maybe a little bit of
even
bias.
With the six interceptions?
Yeah. I mean, that's normal for a Jets quarterback. So
what attracts you to the interceptions?
What's the big deal? No, I mean, I think I'm biased because of what he showed us in the Rose Bowl last year. I mean, I watched every second of that game rooting for Penn State, and the poise that he showed in a big moment coming down the stretch of that Rose Bowl really opened my eyes. And I was going to have my eyes on him, you know, the rest of this season then because of that. And he hasn't done anything. I mean, yeah, interceptions, but he hasn't done anything that's alarming to me where I wouldn't take him on the Jets right now over what we have. So, I think him, Rosen, I'm not sold on him. I mean, his numbers are good. But you look at who UCLA plays and you look at the fact that that's just how that's going to happen. I mean, he's going to put up monstrous stats against, you know, the teams that UCLA plays. And by the way, I mean, UCLA put up 46 points in that game this last week and lost, I believe, to Memphis.
He reminds me a little bit like a Big 12 quarterback that like racks up a ton of yards. And we've seen those guys come into the league with a lot of promise and kind of flop. So I think I agree with you there that, you know, even with a guy like RG3 that went in and just lit the Big 12 up and just looked, by all accounts, you know, even Case Keenum was a guy at Houston that had massive passing yards and just has never developed into the NFL. So I think you might be onto something there, that sometimes you have to look at these guys in big spots in key moments of the game. Now, Rosen did have the big comeback versus A&M, and he made some big throws at the end, but he also made some throws that could have easily been intercepted and would have never even gave him a chance to come back from there. What do you have on the – is there anybody outside the quarterbacks that you like in the Heisman running?
Certainly Saquon Barkley. He's
– I didn't want to steal your thunder, so I wanted to
– Yeah, thanks. Thanks for teeing that up. Thanks for teeing that up for me. I mean, certainly Saquon Barkley. Obviously, being a Penn State homer, I'm going to name him. But he just puts out there these phenomenal performances that aren't always rushing. And so his versatility is what makes him so valuable in potentially as an NFL prospect. And so as a Heisman candidate, I think it's neat to see a running back who can also be a double threat and have the receiving yards. So far this year, his tote, you know, average is 8 yards per carry. That's pretty good. But his receiving average is 22 yards per reception. That's ridiculous. Now he only has he's only accounted for 5 of the Nittany Lions touchdowns, whereas, you know, a guy like Baker Mayfield has already thrown 10 and Mason Rudolph's already thrown 11, or even the running back from Oregon, Royce Freeman, 460 yards and 9 TDs so far. But, you know, Saquon Barkley, I think we'll see. Once we get into these Big Ten games, I think we'll see if he's a Heisman candidate or just an overall good football player that'll go high in the draft. To me, I think Baker Mayfield is, you know, he's going to win the Heisman this year, I think, because There's good pedigree coming from Oklahoma. They've had other Heisman winners there. They certainly stay high on the list of voters as it is. And so if he continues on the streak that he's on and Oklahoma goes on to have a really good season, he may be tough to beat in that Heisman race anyway.
Well, I think that'll do it for our wrap-up with college football. Your boy Saquon Barkley is on primetime. That's the big ABC matchup. There will be a lot of eyeballs on him on Saturday night. We know those primetime games, you get a lot of people watching. If you come out and have a big performance in those spots, that can mean a lot for you going forward. I think you're right with Baker Mayfield. If the Oklahoma can find a way to go undefeated with the efficiency he's playing with right now, he's going to be tough to beat. But there's a lot that like Darnold and Rosen as well. Jackson hasn't looked good in some of his spots. But I think this is a very interesting year, because I don't think there's one guy that's running away with this right now. We just named 6 of them that are going to be in this. So that'll do it for our Talkworthy segment here for segment number 2. When we come back after the break, we'll have our lightning round questions.
All All right, Justin, I'm going to hit you with a little bit of a controversial question. It was released recently that Jones will be stripped of his UFC title after his bout with Cormier because of a potential testing for steroids, which he still denies and still says that he doesn't take steroids. But either way, this man is one of the best fighters the UFC has ever seen. He's 22-1, was 23-1 before they changed that fight with Cormier to a no contest. His only loss came in a situation where he was disqualified for an elbow years ago. But look, this guy is one of the best fighters the UFC has ever seen, and yet he's been stripped of his title three different times for different things. Once for an alleged hit and run, which he was actually convicted of, you know, and other drug suspension allegations. This time he actually goes and fights Cormier, wins the fight, and gets stripped after the fact. Here's my question, though. In a sport like UFC, is there even a need to test these guys, or should we just say they're independent contractors and just let them do it?
Well, I don't know if you want to go that far with it, but, you know, but maybe the fan base doesn't care at that point. Maybe it's a little bit like some that you see in baseball where it's just, well, you know, just let them take whatever. If they want to put different, you know, chemicals in their system that could affect them down the road, you know, that's their decision to make. But the UFC has to do something. I don't understand. They test these guys before bouts and somehow they're clean, but after they're not. It doesn't make any sense to me of why they let these things continue to happen. It's just like the UFC and boxing, it's like every time they get the stage, it's just like they find a way to screw it up. You know, the UFC has a big bout. They create another star in Jon Jones. And then, you know, you're just kind of waiting the next few days to weeks like, well, when's he going to get stripped of his title for doing something illegal? You know, the same with Canelo and Triple G. You get all the boxing eyes on you and you have a judging error where you have a judge that's 10 points off from some of the other ones. It just takes all of it. It just puts such an asterisk over both sports. I really want even to buy, you know, I used to buy some of the UFC pay-per-views. I just got to a point where I stopped. It's same with boxing. I wanted to buy Canelo Triple G, and then I started to think, well, what happens if something weird happens when I watch this? You know, and that's what happened. You know, it was by all accounts a good fight, a close fight, and then you have one judge that's way off, and then there's all this talk about how there's a history of this with this particular judge, and this is a problem with boxing going that's been there. I don't understand why these, you know, boxing and UFC, they just can't get their act together because they have such a tremendous audience that wants to watch and wants to pay for these events. They're just such money makers and that they find ways to just screw it up. It just makes no sense to me. All right, Eric. So your favorite musical artist, Taylor Swift, released a new song. Now, I kind of heard this discussion on the Dan Patrick Show where they were talking about would you date Taylor Swift if you knew there was a potential for a song coming out? I'm not going to ask you that.
Wait, I'm married.
I don't want to get you in hot water there. But another one of our, a hot topic that's been on this show, and we have talked about him several times, was Tiger Woods, that he's now back chipping some golf balls. He put out an Instagram video. I just want to get your take on the general public. I won't ask you, but the general public. Do you think, given the same type of question, if they could have the career Tiger Woods had and experience that, but know what was coming on the back end and the 10 years of PR hell that that man has been through, do you think most people would sign up for that?
That's a tough one because I look at, you know, I look at guys like Jordan Spieth and Ricky Fowler and, you know, even Justin Thomas. You take guys like them, I don't think they would ever sign up for that. I just think that they wouldn't put themselves through that. But if you're talking general population, a guy who maybe works a 9-to-5, he works a tough job, and you give him the opportunity to make that amount of money and be that good at golf for a period of time, but go through the PR nightmare that Tiger Woods has gone through, a lot of it self-inflicted, of course. You know, I would say that probably 60 to 70% of the male population is going to do that because in this world that we live in, fame and fortune seems to rise above a lot of other, you know, moral compass items. And so I just think, yeah, I think a lot of guys would do that. But I think, you know, if you're talking deeper than that and you're looking at guys who are on tour now and potentially could rise to the star of Tiger Woods, and you'd say, okay, Jordan Spieth, would you take 14 majors and, you know, almost 90 worldwide wins and that type of thing, but know that in 10 years, you know, you're going to, you know, cheat on your wife and go through all this, and then you're going to have drug problems, and then you're going to have, I don't know. I don't think he would sign up for that. I think he it's just interesting. Tiger Woods is a whole other case study in and of itself, where you look at the way he had his relationship with his father and then the loss of his father and what all. I think there's a lot of psychological reasons that led to Tiger Woods being where he's at. I think as a golfer, one of the best golfers of all time, if not the best golfer of all time, and as we've said before a couple months ago, I would still love to see Tiger Woods get back to being competitive and battle guys like Jordan and Justin and Ricky and Dustin Johnson and Brooks Koepka, all these guys that are rising on the PGA Tour. What a phenomenal story for golf that would be. But I mean, me sitting here, I wouldn't take that life, just as it's built around Tiger Woods. I wouldn't take it.
No, if you could take some of the money and all that stuff, but even recently with some of the news, I don't know if anybody wants to deal with all that stuff. Money can cover up a lot of things, but
it can't cover up that.
It can't cover up that.
As always, thanks for listening to this edition of Talk Back. Episode 20 is in the books. A lot of NFL coming at you, college football, NASCAR, and even wrapping up the MLB season. But we are looking forward to the NBA preseason kicking off as well. The fall is going to be pretty exciting around here, Justin.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot to talk about. Your favorite NBA player now, Kyrie Irving, just did a sit down with First Take, and he had some telling things to say, so we'll kind of break that down.
I almost threw up.
Maybe discuss that next week if I can keep you from breaking our sound system here so we can keep recording. But yeah, we'll definitely get into that. We'll take a look at, maybe we'll do an NBA preview, take a look at some of the win-losses Vegas has set, see some of the bigger numbers there. I don't think our fans want to hear us talk about the Phoenix Suns or Denver Nuggets chances, but there's some other hot topics that we can get into with that as well in the coming weeks.
You can find us on Twitter at TalkBackFanTalk, and I'm at TalkBackEric.
And I'm at TalkBackJustin.
That wraps up another episode of Talk Back. For Justin, I'm Eric. Thanks for listening.